Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present political analyst Riad Jarrar, who discusses the integrity of Iraq's March 7th parliamentary election and the status of plans for the withdrawal of U.S. troops by December 2011. Ken Green, founder of the Hudson Valley Seed Library, who examines the role of agribusiness in privatizing and monopolizing crop seeds and the resulting threat to biodiversity. And economist Max Wolf, who provides an overview of the ailing U.S. economy and the challenges for workers as productivity increases and unemployment remains high. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Connecticut Senator Chris Dodd, head of the Senate Banking Committee, has floated a proposal to water down consumer protection provisions in pending legislation to overhaul financial regulations. Seeking to woo Republican support, Dodd has given up on establishing an independent consumer financial protection agency and instead has offered to create a less powerful Bureau of Financial Protection within the Treasury Department. According to the Los Angeles Times, the new bureau would take power away from the Federal Reserve and create new rules to protect consumers in financial matters. Dodd is negotiating to craft a compromise with Tennessee Senator Bob Corker, who has insisted the independent consumer agency be stripped out of the bill. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce and the banking industry are fiercely lobbying against the independent consumer body as proposed by President Obama. The banking industry wants the powers to protect consumers left with the Federal Reserve. The Nation magazine reports the Fed refused to enforce its own rules to stop abuses in the mortgage industry that led to the financial collapse in 2008. At the same time, the FBI warned of an epidemic of mortgage fraud in 2004, which the Federal Reserve and other regulators ignored. In late February, ACORN, the Association of Community Organizations for Reform Now, announced a reorganization plan that would break up its network of chapters into independent community groups. ACORN has been in crisis since videos were released on a right-wing website which allegedly showed ACORN staff giving advice on evading taxes and setting up a prostitution ring. The buzz surrounding the videos, made by conservative activist James O'Keefe, led Congress to pass a bill which cut ACORN's funding. But recent investigations have failed to find anything proving criminal conduct in the videos, and O'Keefe now faces criminal charges in an incident involving tampering with phones in the office of Louisiana Senator Mary Landrieu. In recent months, conservatives have turned ACORN into an all-purpose scapegoat, noted the American Prospect magazine. ACORN is blamed for triggering the mortgage crisis and for sinking John McCain's 2008 presidential bid. Ironically, the right-wing crusade has largely ignored ACORN's real-world troubles of bad governance and internal corruption, and instead obsesses over ACORN fixing elections. In December, a federal judge ruled Congress had illegally defunded ACORN, saying the group was never convicted of any wrongdoing and that the bill passed by Congress was unconstitutional. Charles Taylor is now standing trial for war crimes in The Hague, but in the 1990s, the former Liberian president and warlord spent over $2.5 million to win access to the Clinton White House. According to the Washington Post, the most high-profile contact was a meeting between Taylor's wife, Jewel Howard Taylor, and then-First Lady Hillary Rodham Clinton, the current Secretary of State. Liberia's Washington lobbyist, Lester Hyman, set up the meeting. Hyman also sought to set up a high-level meeting between Charles Taylor and President Bill Clinton during a session of the United Nations General Assembly in New York. The meeting fell apart because Taylor refused to travel to UN headquarters. In addition, Hyman met with then-Secretary of State Madeleine Albright to have Taylor's record cleared of criminal charges related to Taylor's escape from a Massachusetts state prison in the 1980s. From 1997 to 1999, Hyman's firm Swidler & Berlin received $630,000 in fees from the government of Liberia. Today, Hyman insists he represented the people of Liberia and not Charles Taylor personally. In the late 1990s, Hyman won the concession to operate Liberia's shipping registry, and conservative televangelist Pat Robertson won a concession for a gold mine in Liberia in 1999. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Richard Hill.
Iraq's first parliamentary election since 2005 took place on March 7th and was hailed by President Barack Obama as a milestone in the nation's progress toward becoming a stable democracy. Despite insurgent bomb and rocket attacks in Baghdad and other cities, which killed 38, the Independent High Electoral Commission estimated voter turnout at 62%, down from the 75% who cast ballots in the last parliamentary election in December 2005. 2 days after the election, and before preliminary results were announced, the two leading political coalitions both claimed victory in the contest for the 325-seat Iraqi parliament. Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki's State of Law coalition was in a tight race with the Erekiya coalition, led by former interim Prime Minister Iyad Alawi. Before the election, more than 500 candidates were banned from running for parliamentary seats due to their alleged ties to Saddam Hussein's outlawed Ba'ath Party. A new controversy erupted after the election when a list of 55 candidates appointed to replace names from the initial banned list were themselves disqualified. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Iraqi-born political analyst Rayed Jarar, a senior fellow with the group Peace Action. Jarar assesses the integrity of the Iraqi election and the status of plans for the withdrawal of U.S. troops by December 2011.
There are three major competing coalitions. Two of them are the current ruling party. And the third one, it's a coalition with most of the opposition leaders who tend to be nationalists. Al-Iraqiya is led by Dr. Alawi and Dr. Saleh Al-Mutlaq, who was banned last month by the Iraqi government. He was accused of being linked to the former Ba'ath Party. What is important to know at this stage is that the Iraqi system, and according to the Iraqi laws, whomever gets the most number of votes now will have the power to create the cabinet. So assign the prime minister and select ministers, and then even create the presidential council, the president and his vice president or her. But of course there are many other steps that must be taken before the government is formed, because whichever coalition wins must create alliances with others to reach to at least half of the seats of the parliament. So it's a longer process. It's way more complicated. It might take a couple of months to finish the entire process.
Raed, some reports quote Sunni voters as being very fearful of the influence of Iran on Iraq's government now and in the future, when and if the United States withdraws their troops from the country. How do you assess Iran's influence currently and the potential for greater influence in the future?
This is not a Sunni or Shiite issue. Looking at the Iraqi domestic or foreign policy through sectarian lenses will always give a distorted picture. So, it's true. There is criticism to the Iranian intervention, but that comes from more or less the same constituency that is critical to the U.S. intervention or to Al-Qaeda's intervention or to the Saudi intervention. So the criticism does not come based on people's sect. It's not like Sunnis are opposed to the Iranian intervention, but Shiites are opposed to the American intervention or whatever other distorted pictures we see through the U.S. mainstream media. The reality is that the majority of Iraqis, regardless of their background, are opposed to all types of intervention. And the majority of Iraqis do not believe that prolonging the U.S. intervention would protect them from the Iranian intervention. So while people would agree that Iran is interfering and might interfere even more in the upcoming months and years, No one thinks that this legitimizes the U.S. intervention to stay longer, because people view both interventions as negative and harmful. So I think Iraqis want the U.S. to withdraw completely, and they want to work very strongly to end the Iranian control over the Iraqi ruling parties. This week's election is yet another step by the Iraqi public to try to reduce the Iranian influence in Iraq by voting for those parties who are opposed to any neighboring countries interfering in Iraq. Mr. Alawi himself is a Shiite, but he is very much opposed to the Iranian role in Iraq or other countries interfering in the country.
Tell us your view of the status of the Obama administration's plans for withdrawal from Iraq, which currently is targeted to withdraw all U.S. combat forces by August 31st and all U.S. troops by December 31st, 2011.
The plan is going ahead despite some attempts by the Pentagon and the U.S. military industrial complex to delay or cancel the plan. There was a request by the Pentagon a couple of weeks ago for contingency plans to delay the withdrawal of combat forces that is supposed to happen before the end of August, but it was not approved. And President Obama reconfirmed his commitment to withdrawing all combat forces by the end of August and all troops by the end of next year. He reconfirmed this during this week's speech that he reached out to the Iraqi public and congratulated them for going out to the polls and reaffirmed his commitment to the withdrawal. I think the Obama administration is going ahead with the withdrawal, but we need to continue the grassroots pressure and grassroots oversight to make sure that these promises become reality.
That was political analyst Riad Jarrar, a senior fellow with the group Peace Action. Read Jarrar's commentaries online at peace-action.org. Most people don't think much about the significance of seeds, but one speaker at the March 6 conference of the Connecticut chapter of the Northeast Organic Farming Association, or NOFA, maintains that seeds are responsible for the development of civilization itself, because food crops enabled humans to evolve from hunter-gatherers to farmers, leading to settled communities and the growth of cities. Ken Green is the founder of Hudson Valley Seed Library, based in the village of Accord, New York. During a workshop at the NOFA conference, Green examined the history of seeds, which for millennia were saved from one year's harvest and planted the next. But with the growth of giant multinational conglomerates like Monsanto, the life of seeds has changed dramatically. When companies patent hybrid seeds, they become private property, which means saving them for the next season becomes illegal. Now, farmers and gardeners are forced to purchase new seeds every year from giant corporations. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus spoke with Green about the history of seeds, the role of private enterprise, and the fight back in the form of seed exchanges and seed banks.
One of the challenges that we've taken up with the Hudson Valley Seed Library is that, you know, food security has become this big buzzword. You know, how are we going to feed people? How are we going to make sure that communities can provide food for themselves? Food, which right now is distributed over many, many miles, how can we be more regional about it? And feed more people. And it's interesting to see that for some people the answer, they're talking about GMOs. When of course with a GMO, it's illegal, they're patented, it's illegal to save your own seed. So if we can't save our own seeds from the plants that we're growing to plant them again, how is that a secure food system? And how is that a sustainable food system? It's not. Because we have to rely on the technology and profit-driven motives of a multinational corporation to dictate what can be grown and how it's grown. And we have to get seed from them every year, and it's expensive seed. So when I started the seed library and I was trying to encourage people and get them to start trying to save seeds on their own, and I started realizing that along with losing the genetic diversity, which is so important, by becoming more dependent on hybrids and GMOs, that we're also losing the seed-saving skills. So many people were saying to me, I don't know how to do this. And if we lose the skills, then we lose our ability to be self-sufficient in terms of food production. So, you know, that's why when we're offering seeds through the seed library and through our online catalog, that everything we offer is open pollinated. And we don't offer any hybrids, and certainly we don't offer any GMOs, so that people can save their own seeds. And we're running the library part of it. It's participatory, so that people can save their own seeds, send them back to us, and then we can mix them with the other seeds that come back from other seed library members and then send them back out, so that we're all sharing the genetic diversity and that we're all cooperating to make sure that we are in charge of our own food sources.
Ken Green, you were talking at the workshop about how multinational companies are basically raiding the seeds that are used by indigenous peoples. Can you say more about that?
Well, there's sort of a word to describe it now. It's called biopiracy. And it's basically for plant breeding, the more genetic material you have, the better. Because you never know what you're going to be looking for as pests and disease change, as climate changes, as what crops become more important or less important change. It's important to have sort of a full palette, genetically speaking, to work with. So, you know, it's not just now. For ages and ages, people have been traveling and finding new plants and collecting seed from them to have, you know, a seed bank, whether it's a government or a corporation. But what's happening now, the thing that's really changed about it is that corporations have really been pushing to be able to patent genes. And it started with the GMOs in terms of they were actually inserting technology, you know, technologically changing the genetic makeup of something, and so they could patent that. But what's happening now is there's, you know, a lot of movement and pressure from corporations that they want to be able to patent existing genetic makeups or existing single genes even. So they can go to whatever culture they want to where they see something that they think might be useful. They take the seeds, and then they say, we want to patent it. But they're not recognizing that it's been thousands and thousands and thousands of years breeding work on the part of whatever culture they're taking that seed from that created that genetic makeup. So it was really somebody else's work. So why should they be able to patent it, you know, as a quote-unquote discovery when it exists because it exists within a culture and because of the work of a certain culture.
You have your seed libraries. There are other seed exchanges and seed banks. Is seed saving something that's growing, so to speak, and that might combat some of the negative tendencies we just talked about?
You know, I think on a grassroots level, in terms of home gardeners, saving seed and sharing seed with each other in any form, you know, even if it's just between neighbors or family or, you know, at your community center, doesn't have to be a library or a bank or anything official. I think it's really important work for communities and important for us to be sharing those seed resources on a larger scale in terms of what's happening more globally. I think there are more organizations, non-governmental organizations, getting involved in these issues. But one of the things that we were talking about at the conference was that just because it's called a seed bank or a seed library or a seed exchange, there's no specific definition of those entities, so everyone does it differently. And there's something great about that in that you can tailor it to your community and to the people who are involved, but you also have to really look into it to see, like, what, you know, what does it mean? Who's benefiting from this? Who's behind this? What is it really for?
That was Ken Green of the Hudson Valley Seed Library. For more information, visit the group's website at seedlibrary.org. U.S. workers lost 8.4 million jobs since the economic meltdown began in December 2007, and although economists tell us the deepest recession since the Great Depression has officially ended, the unemployment rate is steady at 9.7% as of February 2010. In a sign of rising pessimism about the economic future, 41% of the nation's unemployed have been out of work for at least 27 weeks. The U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics reported that in the fourth quarter of 2009, worker productivity increased at a 6.9% annual rate, revised upward from the initial 6.2% reported in February. The rise in productivity provides an explanation how the U.S. economy could have grown at an impressive rate of 5.9% in the final quarter of 2009, while unemployment remained at near record levels. Increased worker productivity reflects current strategies that businesses have employed to cut costs to the bone by laying off their workforce and demanding ever-increasing productive output and efficiency from fewer workers. With jobs scarce and labor unions in an extremely weak position to make demands on employers, wages and benefits for an increasingly more productive workforce are stagnating or in decline. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with economist Max Wolf, an instructor at the New School University's graduate program in international affairs. Wolf provides an overview of the ailing U.S. economy and the challenges for workers as productivity increases and unemployment remains high.
Generally speaking, the top 20% by income here are doing okay, and the stock market's now up 68% from its March 9th lows. So exactly 1 year ago, we would have been talking about an absolute freefall disaster, and about the worst 18-month period in the modern history of the stock market had just been clocked going into March 2009. And as we stand here 1 year hence, the stock market is up 68% from a year ago. We've seen no increase in taxes and no new financial regulations. So while there's still lots of huge and undealt with underlying economic problems, for the top 20%, large corporations and financial markets, it's been one of the best years of the last 100, with, of course, some noteworthy exceptions. The home builders have had some trouble, and some of the retail space have fared poorly. But generally speaking, the top 20% by income here are doing okay. Unfortunately, the other 80-plus percent of the population still faces officially 9.7% unemployment, and underemployment, which includes people who've given up looking and people who are what we call involuntarily part-time. So they want full-time work, they need full-time work, but they can't find it. That's now 16.5% of the U.S. public is that involuntary part-timers. So we really do see a lot of Main Street pain. We have 7.1 million homes on which the mortgages are at least 30 days late at the present time and a clogged-up foreclosure pipeline. So the bottom 80% and the top 20% are almost like they're in two different economies here. And I think we've begun to see the reflection of that in some of the sort of more outrageous political events of the last 6 months.
Max, review for us some of the most recent data on productivity versus unemployment in the U.S. economy.
So we saw productivity soar across the second half of 2009, particularly in the last quarter of 2009. And unfortunately, that's the newest data we have. So we don't have productivity for 2010 yet. The first estimates of that won't begin to come out for a little bit more than another month hence. So we don't really know the whole first quarter. But at the end of 2009 and the beginning of 2010, we saw two things happen together. We saw a massive increase in productivity, where that measures the value or output produced per worker per hour. And we saw this occur at the same time as employment tanked and total wages fell. So the total value produced by American workers rose, but the hours and the pay of American workers fell as people worked harder and harder as various employers around the country just ran skeleton crews or a smaller number of people were producing an enormous amount of things. And this begins to give us the kind of the politics we have as an expression of this too. You have people scared to lose their job with stingy benefits who are afraid to complain, who aren't getting wages increased, you know, wage increases or salary increases, who are afraid to complain, who are worked ragged and to the bone, and then we have 14.5 to 15 million people who can't find a job at all. And unfortunately, these things are obviously related, and because the labor market's so weak, you're able to work your remaining employees very hard, demand a lot from them, and pay them relatively little. And this isn't in one part of the country versus another, or in one sector or type of job versus another. This is kind of on the macro level, all 50 states. So this is a pattern, and we've seen a version of this really since the 70s, where productivity keeps rising and wages don't. But this has gone kind of hyperbolic, or this, you know, if you think of it in terms of an image, the slope or the grade on the curve has suddenly shifted kind of radically up in the last maybe 12 months. And I think a lot of people feel this at work. They're either out of work or they're working extra hard because people who they should have hired or who used to work with them quite simply aren't there anymore.
Well, Max, Are there alternative policies that the Obama administration could pursue or Congress could push or grassroots movements here at the street level could protest in favor of? What could be done at this point to kind of get this thing back in balance so that workers are being compensated for their increased productivity?
Well, I mean, the first thing is we can start with where the Obama administration did suggest and broadcast what I think were some pretty valuable ideas when they were in the process of becoming the administration and running for office, and that is this real commitment we were going to see to green jobs and infrastructure. And, thus far it takes a while to do this, and you don't want to unfairly, harshly judge too quickly, but paying for it and actually getting the ball rolling in this area has been a day late and a dollar short all along. And I think the things that people could really begin to look at is we need a national system of public transit. We need it for the environment. We need it for our balance of trade. And I think the federal government also needs to be honest and say, if the private sector can't find anything to do for 15 million people and the economy is struggling and we have 7 million homes in the foreclosure pipeline, then the federal government itself has to throw off this sort of ideological yoke that it can't hire people. It has to go out and it has to hire people. Not in some highly corrupt thing where the local party bosses pick their cousin for no-show jobs, but where the government really, in an audited, transparent way, goes out and starts doing things that the society needs, that the private sector is not going to do, like infrastructure and public goods and public transit, that give people jobs. Because part of the reason you give people jobs isn't just for the income, although, of course, that's important, but it's to give them a record of work, to get them ready to work, and to give people dignity and a sense that they're the master of their own destiny. And giving people checks and inducements to buy houses and cars doesn't give people a resume. It doesn't give them a sense of meaning and importance in the world. It doesn't give them the dignity that a job gives them. And I think we all could agree that there's a lot we need to get done in this society that isn't getting done. So we have the people. We have the need. I think that's more than enough to throw off this ideological yoke about the government never hiring anyone and begin to roll our shirts up and go back to work. We've seen it work before, and I think we need it again.
That was economist Max Wolf, an instructor at the New School University's graduate program in international affairs. Read his commentaries online at HuffingtonPost.com. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced in association with WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-268-8446 or write to Between the Lines, care of Squeaky Wheel Productions, P.O. Box 110176, Trumbull, Connecticut, 06611. Visit our website at btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Richard Hill, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.